From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a bright, cold day in April when the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his chest in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. Thus begins the novel 1984 by George Orwell, published 70 years ago this week. Orwell packed many themes into his novel that The New Yorker recently called a prophecy that never seems to fall out of relevance. In 1984, the government records and monitors all the actions of the citizenry. There is essentially no private life, and independent thought is squelched by an oppressive government that is busy installing its own language, newspeak. The government wants to limit the vocabulary used by citizens because with fewer words, there will be fewer unique ideas. Conformity is the goal. Did you read 1984? Did the themes stick with you? Do they resonate today? This hour, we've convened a panel to discuss not just the themes, but the ways that fiction can influence society. And if they were writing a book called, 2054, which themes might they weave into a novel meant to warn readers? What do they see 35 years into the future that worries them? This hour, we'll engage in thought crimes. We'll go down the memory hole, knowing that Big Brother is always watching. Our guests this hour include Christine Green, a freelance literary arts journalist and teaching artist. Christine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Greg Girard, who is author of Jupiter's Shadow, editor of the Big Brick Review, and teacher of creative writing at Writers and Books. Greg, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Alex Sanchez is on the phone with us. He is the author of Rainbow Boys and other teen novels and currently working on a graphic novel for DC Comics. Alex, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks.
For me, I confess, this is a book that I had to go back and spend some time on the last night, this morning, because, of course, probably like all of humanity, I read it, and a lot of the things sort of embedded with me, but it's been a little while here. So, Christine, when's the first time you remember encountering it? Back in school, probably, I assume.
Yeah, that'd be in high school in the late 80s, early 90s. And I admit I haven't read it since then, but again, like you said, it embeds itself in you. It's one that you read once and it sticks with you. Greg and I were talking about Handmaid's Tale out in the hallway, mm-hmm. and talk about a dystopian future, but that's another one in high school that just, it sticks with you. You don't forget those themes.
Yeah, I didn't know until the last 24 hours researching for this that Big Brother in certain terms actually came straight from that we still use quite often. Mm-hmm. That's how impactful it was. What about you, Greg?
Similar story. I haven't read 1984 since high school at McQuaid, but graduated in 1984, so it was the theme for our yearbook. So.
It was big that year.
It was very
a
everything.
A surge in sales. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that might have been the year that the ad, the Super Bowl ad.
That was in my mind this whole morning.
Yes.
Big Brother is watching.
Yeah.
What about you, Alex?
Yeah, the same as with Christine and Greg. It was back in high school, but I think the reason it stays so fresh is because it's just become such a part of the culture that we constantly refer to it. So it seems like I just read it yesterday.
So I want to ask all of you about some sort of broad sweeping questions about literature here, because this is a book that is still referred to often. It is probably used as sort of evidence by people on different sides of the political spectrum. And I have a really interesting email, which we'll get to later this hour. And I'll also ask listeners, if you want to weigh in as we think about 1984, the power of literature, and maybe what the next 35 years would bring in terms of your concerns. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. Christine, George Orwell, didn't know that he was going to write a book that was going to be discussed 70 years later on something called a talk show.
Yeah.
though he talked in the book about technology without having ever seen a TV screen, he essentially invented that, these telescreens that government used to watch you, which actually happens in places like North Korea and elsewhere. How powerful do you think fiction can be, and do we sort of underrate the ability of fiction to shape public conversations about these kind of issues?
I think some people underrate it. I think writers and avid readers don't. I think, and I just brought up The Handmaid's Tale a moment ago, but I'll use that example again, it is we're in a time where not only the book itself, but the show is so powerful because it's pulling on themes that we're living every day. And so I think there are so many books that really stick with us. And I think they can be almost little bits of the future in these books. And I don't know if I'm articulating correctly, but so essentially, yes, it's...
Yeah, I I'm thinking, you know, for authors who are, whether you're writing your own story, a memoir, perhaps, I don't know, growing up gay in a private Catholic school, something like that, Greg Girard. but whatever it is that you're writing, are you hoping as an author that it's going to land with society, that it's going to change conversations, or are you simply either telling a story or writing your own? I mean, is it possible that even someone like Orwell could have imagined how large this could become?
I think I have two thoughts on that. The first one is, I think we all write as writers because we have a drive to tell a story. So I think that's the prime motivation to get us, you know, pen to paper or, you know, fingers to the keyboard. Mm-hmm. That said, I know personally for me, I get motivated by thinking, hey, this is going to be the next Stephen King, a bestseller, or people will react to this. I'm writing a fiction book right now that I'm trying to sort my way through, and what I desire for it is to have it move people. I want some scenes to make people cry, and I want to figure out, you know, how to be authentic and how to be true to that scene and true to the characters and make an experience that will move people. Now, I'm not thinking, are people going to 35 years from now be reading that and talking about it? No, I'm just thinking about the story I want to tell and how words have the power to move people.
I want to return to this question in just a second, because Greg's got me thinking about the idea that artists have a story to tell, and then the question is, does the audience interpret that story the way the artist wanted, which is always, I'm always curious about. What about you, Alex? You know, how powerful do you think the pen and the page can be, especially in sort of in the context of something like 1984?
Well, I'd agree with Christine and Greg that you know, especially for young people, you know, that oftentimes we can look back and think of, wow, that book really opened my eyes or opened my mind, you know, opened my heart, you know, especially when we're so impressionable as young people. And I think it's no wonder, you know, that 1984 is taught in schools, because I think it really opens up young people to think, look at different ways to see things. And certainly in terms of you know, my own works, where, you know, I've seen how they've worked as, you know, both windows and mirrors, where you know, writing about gay teens, you know, has opened eyes for other non-gay teens to see, oh, well, that's what it's like, and that, you know, point of validation for the gay teens themselves. And, you know, it's sometimes it's not talked about in schools, you know, where we learn about language in terms and books in terms of imagery and symbols and things like that, and not as instruments of social change. But I think teachers oftentimes have that in mind, you know, when they'll teach James Baldwin or Amy Tan, Maxine Hong's Kingston, to open young people up to different societies and cultures and points of view. So I think books can be very formative, especially for young people.
This is one of the strange ones, though, that with 1984, that you see it kind of, I mean, I use the word appropriated, I'm not even sure that's fair, but you sort of see it weaponized on the political left, the political right, people to make different points. And, you know, when it came to capitalism and socialism, George Orwell himself declared himself to be a democratic socialist. He wanted to use democracy to achieve the goals of socialism without a fully socialistic society, and he warned against unfettered capitalism. He once wrote, not in 1984, he once wrote, quote, "I have seen British imperialism at work in Burma, and I have seen something the effects of poverty and unemployment in Britain. One has got to be actively a socialist, not merely sympathetic to socialism, or one plays into the hands of our always active enemies." End quote. He also opposed Stalin and Franco and totalitarianism. And the author John Green recently re-reviewed 1984, and his verdict was that the modern political left and right have no full claim to Orwell. Green said, quote, "Orwell seeks to show the ways that many government structures are prone to totalitarianism, and they chart the slow, almost unnoticeable descent into that totalitarianism." End quote. Now, that's not to say that Orwell didn't have specific points that the left could grab onto or the right could grab onto. But I want to ask all of you about this. When you are reading, Are you trying to read as bias-free as we can? And no one is bias-free. Well, that's not how the human mind works. But are you trying to read to kind of with as open mind as you can? Or are you going, oh, well, this is going to help me make this point against this political opponent? Because when we do that, I fear that we might miss a little bit of something. Christine, how do you feel about that?
It's interesting. I think it depends on why I'm reading the book. So, you know, I read a lot of books just that I pick on my own. And then I read a lot of books to review or to profile the author. And so I definitely have kind of two brains when I'm reading those kind of books, and depending on which one I'm reading. And I try to be very unbiased in general. But like you said, it's just impossible in reality. So when I'm reading books for review, I try to really put on that kind of, all right, I'm going to be very fair. I'm going to just kind of see everything for what it is. But when I'm reading on my own, I'm just like, you know, I'm either cheering like, yeah, and or whatever. The reality is, so it all meshes together because we're human beings. And fiction particularly is, at the core, it's meant to move us. It's meant to move us. You can't read, you just cannot read unbiasedly, no matter how much you try. Now, when I write about it, I am going to be as unbiased as possible. But to be honest, I'm not really attracted to books that have hard political leanings. Mm-hmm. That said, a lot of books that would say, "Oh, there's no politics in this book," they're woven through all the time anyway. So, like I said, overtly political themes. If someone were to hand me, if 1984 came out right now as an adult and it was just kind of a new book, I might kind of just look at the back cover and move on, to be quite honest, until a buzz came up or I was assigned it to read. And it's interesting. My daughter recently read, she's 18, senior, graduating, 1984. And I'm really interested. We didn't talk a lot about it, but as I'm sitting here, I can't wait for tonight's dinner conversation because I really want to get into what does this kid think of this right now? So I'll report back.
Okay. Our next hour, by the way, we're talking about hate and how people become indoctrinated with hate, but also how to change minds and what it is that prevents the world from just becoming echo chambers that sort of harden themselves. So I don't mean to be wishy-washy. I do have an interesting email that I'll read from a listener who's making a point on sort of both sides. I'm not trying to both sides of this argument, because for those who see 1984 and Orwell and Donald Trump, I get that, and we'll talk about that. Language is important. Truth and the shaping of memory and the shaping of understood truth is important, and that is a big theme, and those concerns or complaints are well-founded. But Greg, how do you see, you know, this desire to appropriate? I mean, if someone picked up In Jupiter's Shadow and they said, look, this is why we should be defrocking gay priests. And you're going, wait, that's not the point at all here. As the artist, how concerned are you if someone isn't getting the message that you wanted them to get?
I think for me personally, if you start that conversation, you've achieved a goal, and that is to help people understand people. The parallels in my life are growing up gay and Catholic and having that profound struggle for a lot of my youth, and now in a position to see the different side of what I saw when I was a kid. The most effective change I've seen in other people's hearts or minds come through the sharing of personal stories and the interaction. So books are a means to that end. It enables the conversation for change. Now, whether people will step up and embrace the change, that's a whole separate topic, but at least it's a part of the package.
You know, if you could eavesdrop on a book group that's talking about In Jupiter's Shadow.
Now, that would be cool, but
wouldn't that be cool? But would you find yourself pulling what little remaining hair you have left out of your head? That's okay. No. Look. As a champion of male pattern baldness myself, I can go there. Or would you say, hey, even if half the room isn't quite getting where I was going with this, at least they're talking about it.
That's my first gut reaction. Now, if I were actually hearing the conversation and it got ugly, I might, you know, have some stronger reactions. I submitted an essay once called A Gay Man's Guide to the Prom, because I had gone to a prom with to up our prom with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote an essay about that, and it won third prize in this particular contest. And the editor of that contest contacted me on the side and said, you know, I really thought your essay was kind of first prize material, but we still have, in my judging panel, we still have people with some really conservative opinions, and that shot it down a couple of pegs. And, you know, I was sad to hear that, not so much that I didn't win first prize, but that we're still talking about those, we're still struggling with those social issues today.
So I do wonder what Orwell would think if he could hang out in book groups today, listening to people discuss, especially sort of in the age of Trump. Alex, how do you feel about that? I mean, if you could eavesdrop on groups talking about your work, how much would it bother you if you felt like they were slightly off in the receiving some of the themes? And how much would you sort of find yourself wanting to jump in and correct it?
Oh, I definitely want to jump in and correct it.
But, I love we can at least admit that. That's very human.
You know, what's wonderful about especially fiction is, you know, stories have such power. You know, we you know, as human beings, we learn and communicate so much through stories. And what I think stories allow us is to, you know, they can really, you know, I get so excited when a book really opens my mind to a new way of looking at things. So, you know, my job is as an author is to, you know, create, you know, compelling conflicts where, you know, I can see different sides of things, and the reader is exploring different sides of things so that, you know, they will come to their own dialogues. And part of what is exciting as an author is, yes, I have my points of view, but then when I hear people talking about, you know, a story I've wrote or, you know, I've written, or when I participate in a book discussion, is hearing different points of view. And lots of times it's very exciting. You know, I come in with one set of thoughts, and then I walk away with a different set of thoughts, because that work of art has opened up a dialogue or discussion and opened me up to seeing things from different points of view. So you know, on the one hand, yeah, I have my point of view, but hopefully I'm writing, you know, with enough conflict of different points of view that then it opens up discussion to seeing different sides.
Frank in Greece, Carol in Rochester, we'll come to you on the phones in just a second. Here is a tweet from Julie. A lot of people are sharing their own recollections on when they first encountered 1984. This is interesting. Julie says, read it in 1992, and the lit teacher did a 1984 experiment. We couldn't speak all day, and if caught by the thought police, you lost your chocolate ration handed out in class. The teacher's name was Brody, and she hung signs saying, Big Brody is watching you. Definitely made it more interesting. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, Julie. And here's an email from Steven who says, Hi, Evan. I'm glad you're talking about 1984 today, one of the books that impacted me most. I'm a very progressive person, pretty significantly left in the political spectrum, but I see warnings from Orwell for both my conservative friends and my progressive friends. On the conservative side, duh, we're absolutely looking at the kind of informational manipulation that Orwell wrote about in 1984. Up is down, good is bad, loud is quiet, I could go on. Our president invents reality and is immune to correction, and millions of his fans lap it up and are also immune to actual information. But here's what I think my progressive friends miss. Orwell was also warning against the government's restriction of language, which in turn led to a restriction of thought. The less language a citizenry can use, the less dynamic their thoughts will be. My progressive friends are justifiably concerned about social justice and its goals. But when we try to destroy someone's career over using a word or a phrase or sharing an idea that we don't like, my sense is that we simply feed into the fuel for our political opponents. We can win the battle of ideas by expressing more ideas and better ideas instead of trying to stifle someone else's ideas. At least, I think that's what Orwell would say. Great show. Thank you for that, Stephen. Alex, what do you think?
In terms of what?
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel about that language portion? Because a big part of 1984 that I think writers still talk about is the warning against trying to make language so narrow and for the government to define what is either offensive or illegal or a crime speak, that kind of a thing, that that the government would actually manipulate language to try to limit the citizenry's ideas. So Stephen is emailing to say, look, this worries me because I see the battle of ideas expressed and people want to ban phrases or words or get people fired for saying certain things. And he thinks it doesn't work. He thinks sort of that's, I guess, Orwellian.
Well, I guess from an author's point of view, part of what fascinates me is the way that, and especially, writing for and about teens, is the way that language is always changing. And so on the one hand, I see how these euphemisms that we hear so often, in politics, of not really saying what speaking in code and not really saying what, they should be saying, whether we use enhanced interrogation in terms of torture. But in the end, it's sort of like the language continues to change. So it's like, okay, so now we all know we're talking about torture, even though we're not saying the word torture. So it's like, I guess it's fascinating for me to be in the midst of it and not really sure, where it's going to go, because language is constantly changing.
Greg, what do you think?
I was nodding my head when you were reading Stephen's emails, but my thought, we're talking about being PC is what I'm hearing from this conversation. And I think being politically correct has its place as far as being polite to each other and how we communicate and how we disagree. If that interaction is civil, I think that's a very appropriate place to have that. I think it's a really slippery slope, though, to head down to a place where you can't say a certain word or somebody gets fired for a misspeak on TV or anything. That's what I'm thinking of from that comment. I think we limit our choices. We limit – people are afraid to speak about what they thought. So we're heading down the Orwellian path, I guess, if you're afraid to share things in a civil and honest way.
Yeah. So on that point, by the way, Greg brings up the term politically correct. I think it's always valuable to ask people what they mean by that, because I think it's gotten too pejorative a connotation. I think for the most part, political correctness is a good goal. Not being a blankety blank, not being a jerk, not being unnecessarily rude, is a good thing. If it means, though, stifling thought because you're worried about offending or you don't know if you'll offend, then that's probably problematic. But too often when people say, well, you just want me to be politically correct, what they're actually saying is you just want I just want an excuse to say terrible or hurtful things. Mm-hmm. So I find it important to sort of define the terms. But overall, I think Greg's making a good point here. I don't think being PC or politically correct is a bad thing, respecting others. And the way, to Alex's point, language evolves and changes. And understanding what was said 50 years ago, if it's said today, may land a different way and may hurt. That's okay to acknowledge that. What's not okay, I think, is to kind of create this atmosphere where people feel hamstrung from speaking because they don't know if they can or if it will lead to some sort of a – I think there should be consequences for actions, but I think what I'm trying to say with this, Christine, is I think more expression is good, restricting expression generally bad. We're talking generally here.
Yeah. So many thoughts, and let me see if I can coalesce them. The first thing I would say is if you're afraid to say it, you need to sit back and think about what you're about to say. And not
there might be a reason you're afraid to say what you're saying.
Yeah, not because I think from often what I hear, in social media, in the news, and even from people in person, they say, "Oh, I'm afraid to say those things." It's like you're afraid to say those things because someone's going to call you out for being a jerk. That you have to really think about, why are you afraid of that? Are you afraid because the big bad language police are going to come and police your thoughts? Are you afraid because the world is going to look at you like you really are? So that sounds a little harsh, but there's a difference between policing thoughts and policing hate language. And I don't want to police someone's thoughts. And I have, on that same vein, I have every right to think that they are maybe a terrible person for having those thoughts, or that I disagree, or that I want to have a conversation because their thoughts are so different. But I don't. I think there are certain words or certain phrases, there are certain very painful things that just should not be said to people, particularly in a public forum or on the news or on TV or anything. And I'm obviously not going to say them here, but I think most of your listeners can have an imagination and listen to the news. We know kind of where we're going with this in terms of homophobic speech,
racist speech.
Misogynistic speech. So. It's a big topic.
And Stephen, I appreciate the email. I mean, I don't think Stephen is equating a social cost to saying terrible things with what Orwellian, you know, the Orwellian, you know, outline of language was, which was you literally can't say it. It's crime speak. You're going to be killed or put in jail by the government if you do this. And we're and the government in 1984 was creating newspeak, a whole new set of language to kind of define away and to remove from language the very ideas of dissidence and political opposition. They just wanted loyalty to the party. So that's, you know, obviously that's a different level. It's a different line.
Yeah.
But there really is right now, the first part of his email also rings true for me. We're at a point where up is down and loud is quiet. I mean, we have we have reached a point where we have a president who doesn't care if you correct him on facts and will continue to state things that are not true. The Central Park Five. I mean, Ava DuVernay's amazing work on this that everyone's talking about is just one small example. And these people's lives were at risk here. And you've got a president who does not care because he's just going to state whatever reality he wants. And for tens of millions of people, that actually just becomes reality. Mm-hmm. Facts be damned. That is Orwellian, I think. What do you think, Christine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, he just said, was it yesterday, something about the moon and the Mars, that the moon actually orbited Mars or something to that effect? I mean, it was kind of tweeted all over the place. And, you know, when he said Frederick Douglass was a great guy, you know, and people laugh, but it's not funny. It's terribly frightening because there are people who just, I saw a bumper sticker just yesterday, I think it was in 531 on the West Side, and it said, "I don't listen to what the liberal media says, Trump 2020." And I here we are. This is where we live. And I don't know. I find it frightening.
And to be fair, I'll get Greg and Alex to respond there, and then we'll take some of your phone calls. To be fair to listeners who may be supporters of the president,
sure.
Let me just say, this isn't intended to be right or left politically, but this is a case where we do have a unique situation where the most powerful human being on the planet right now doesn't care if facts are right or wrong, isn't really interested in that, and has told one of his past biographers, the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal, ghost wrote with Donald Trump, said that Donald Trump would say, it doesn't matter if it's true or not if you can make people believe it.
Mm-hmm.
That, Greg, that's Orwellian.
That's like P.T. Barnum, yeah. But but it is Orwellian. I think the piece of this that it fascinates me is I think the technology has enabled that to happen.
Mm.
And so that's where I start thinking about the future and what AI will contribute and what the technology changes so rapidly since from when I was a kid. I was just talking to my chiropractor this week about, you know, I remember when I was a kid and I could go for a walk by a creek with a dog and not have a phone and my mom, you know, expect me back by dinner. And he was talking about his kids. Well, they're probably going to think, remember back when we drove our own cars. And, you know, so that's where my mind goes. What is technology and what is AI going to present to us and continue to move this bar in one direction or in both directions where everybody has a voice because everybody's got a phone and a tweet and that's to the whole world. But, you know, who believes what and how can you come to a consensus on a fact or what is the truth if nobody's listening or everybody's listening, you know, that kind of mashup.
See, before the hour is over, we're going to ask the writers on the panel how they would envision this if they were writing the next 2054 as a novel. Alex, how do you feel about the way I think Orwell at least did warn us that when facts don't matter anymore, we're entering a weird place?
Well, certainly facts do matter, but I think even though, you know, probably everyone could agree, well, facts do matter, it's like people will still have their own sort of cafeteria view of the world and pick and choose, you know, what they choose to believe in and think and what not to believe in and think. And I think, you know, in terms of the current administration, I'm not so sure that, you know, people are thinking things or believing things because the president says so, but rather that he's giving voice to people who already have those similar or same thoughts and attitudes. So that's sort of the way I see it. And the reality is not everyone is always going to think the same. And I wish everyone thought the same as I do, but they're not going to. And so I think the challenge for a democracy is, well, what to do about that then, when we have people who are choosing to believe things and act in ways that, you know, some of us don't agree with. It's both, you know, exciting and terribly challenging and sometimes, yeah, very worrying. And at the same time, it's like, well, you know, I'm not sure, you know, what the alternative is, you know, if we don't have that ongoing conflict.
Well, let's take our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your phone calls. And our guests are demonstrating just the power of literature. Here we are 70 years since the publication of Orwell's 1984, and we're talking about some of the themes, that power that literature can have in getting society to at least consider and grapple with these themes and their own perspectives. Alex Sanchez, you just heard him on the phone, who's a author of Rainbow Boys and other teen novels and currently working on a graphic novel for DC Comics. Greg Girard is here, author of Jupiter's Shadow, the editor of the Big Brick Review and teacher of creative writing at Writers and Books. Christine Green is a freelance literary arts journalist and a teaching artist. We're back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the intersection between anti-black racism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. And then, a conversation about how we can bridge divides. How can you reach across and pull someone who is overcome with hate into changing their mind? What works? What doesn't? We'll talk about that next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Paul in Webster, first on the phone. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, so a couple things. First of all, I consider myself a conservative. And however, a lot of times what happens is conservatives get put into a box. I volunteered at soup kitchens, homeless shelters. I've made donations throughout my life, and I'm about 50 years old. So I give back to my community. And in fact, I actually agree with a lot of the things that our current president, he is our president, mm-hmm. Donald Trump,
yep.
but a lot of the things that he says. And I almost feel like what you're talking about in this show is Orwellian in a lot of ways, because what you're doing is you make persons or individuals like me feel like I'm being classified as racist, or I'm being classified as crazy, or you know, not accepting the truth by agreeing with our current president.
Okay,
I think that it's a slippery slope. I think that
sure.
that you in fact are being the thing that you think is the enemy of the people. So I think it's a slippery slope, and I think that in a lot of cases, liberals today, or people with liberal mindsets, tend to put people that don't think the way they do, and let's call that thought police, into a category as being racist or bigots.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Paul, stay on the line, because I'm really glad you called here. A couple of points that I kind of want to work through with you, because I want to kind of have a little conversation about this. Number one, I'm thrilled that you called, and I don't want you to feel sort of suppressed or judged or your ideas not welcomed. I mean, that is, if you're feeling that way, then I'm not doing my job. I am trying to be direct about, you know, just how I kind of view the factual landscape. I mean, people can debate political ideology, but there's a difference between that and then having a president, for example, who gets elected and then says, you know, biggest Republican margin ever or in the last 50 years or whatever. And it turns out it's nothing even close to that for a Republican elected. And the media tells him, no, you're not correct. This is incorrect. And the next day he's out saying the exact same thing because he doesn't care. He wants to create his own set of facts that further entrench his sort of superiority or his standing. And that's weird,
right,
man. I find that really weird.
Everything that you're saying there, like the words that you're using, like his superiority or his standing, I actually, when I watch the media, I think that it's consistently and constantly unfair to the president. Whether or not the president does get caught in lies, President Obama, Bill Clinton, George Bush, all of the prior presidents, unfortunately, this day and age, it seems like most politicians lie. And instead of focusing on any of his accomplishments, it tends to be a focus on anti-Trump.
Okay.
And
yeah.
You know, she was just talking about somebody that had a bumper sticker and she immediately judged that individual. You know, it says Trump 2020. Like, this person is an enemy of the people.
No.
Enemy of free thought.
So, Paul, let me just jump in and say what Christine's point there was, not to say Trump 2020 is the problem. It's I don't trust the liberal media, as if anything reported on the news I will automatically reject, no matter how much veracity, because it goes against what I want. And that is the Orwellian part of it.
It's interesting because I wasn't born yesterday. I read 1984. I actually went to McQuaid. I was an honor student, and I completely understand Orwell's message. What's interesting is if I turn on CNN and I watch Cuomo talk about Trump, the candor is so one-sided, is so against the guy, that I believe that the media, in a lot of people's eyes, I believe that people see a credibility issue. Whether or not Trump is right or wrong, it just becomes such an anti-Trump focus. And, you know, let me give you another example of thought police, right? There's a lot of, in pop culture right now, there's a lot of rap music and that uses the N-word, okay? I'm not condoning the use of the N-word, but if you have a 15-year-old Caucasian child that likes to listen to rap music, and that N-word happens to be in that song, does that mean that that child cannot sing the lyrics to that song because he's Caucasian, and you can only sing the lyrics to that song if you're of African descent? You see what I'm saying? The thought police is the pendulum is swinging in the opposite direction.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of the liberals need to be aware that what they're actually they think that they're fighting, they're actually becoming a part of the problem.
Yeah, and which is why I read Stephen's email, who considers himself a progressive, but I think he largely agrees with your critique there. But I would say this, Paul, just take the example you gave with rap music, because last week somebody called the program with a similar point that, well, hey, if black people can say the N-word in songs, why can't white people say it? And do you accept that there is something pretty complex here with a country that's had a history starting with slavery, oppression, economic inequality, and dispossession, and the use of that word to sort of subjugate or make someone lesser than, that when someone who is white says it, it might be different than a person who is African-American? Do you accept that complexity?
I believe that there's a lot of – one of the things that my father taught me at a very young age is sometimes it's not what you say but how you say it. So I think that if somebody uses that word in a condescending and pointed way, for example, I'm Italian, right? And you know, people can use a lot of slangs towards Italians. And my grandparents and great grandparents talked about times where it said Italians need not apply on the front of stores. Now hiring Italians need not apply. Now I don't hold that against other individuals in society. You know, I understand the history. And, you know, if somebody was to make an Italian joke towards me, the tone in their joke and the intentions that they had and the use of the words would make a big difference in the delivery of what they're trying to say. So what I'm trying to say is if the N-word is in a song and a child is listening to that song and likes that song and they're Caucasian and they sing the lyrics to that song, that's the artist's choice to make those lyrics part of that song. And if, you know, the fact that that individual is Caucasian and they can't use the lyrics to that song is actually thought police, and it's wrong. Now, if that Caucasian child walks out on the street and starts in a very belligerent and hurtful way calling people of African descent that word, meaning it to be a very hurtful thing, then they're in the wrong. So I think that the absolutes that are taking place in society it's a slippery slope. You know, so if somebody has a Trump 2020 bumper sticker on their car, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily a bad person.
No, I hear you. I hear you, Paul, and I got to let our panelists respond, but I will also say this. You identified yourself as a conservative. You talked about your volunteer work. None of that is surprising. I mean, I the last thing I hope you think is that people would think conservatives aren't charitable, giving people who can show all kinds of acts of kindness, profound kindness, and charity. And that doesn't surprise me at all. And I'm glad you called. And I hope you listen next hour. We're going to talk about some themes that I think you may have something to say. But I'm glad you listen when you do, too. So thanks for calling.
Yeah, I do. No, I do listen. I do listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. So, Christine, I'll start with you because he kind of referenced the bumper sticker part. And he thought that that was Orwellian. I mean, he thinks that kind of judgment is too broad-based and kind of suppressing the other ideas.
Okay, so, I mean, I think he has an interesting point of view. And when I said, you know, that the sticker said I don't listen to what the liberal media says, Trump 2020, this driver of this car was saying, I support Trump and I don't believe the liberal media. So I wasn't making an assumption. I was reading the bumper sticker on this particular individual's car. You know, that said, I think, you know, we could go on and on and on. And I think we're getting almost, I'd love to talk more about the books again and literature, but I think this is a really important discussion because one of the things that I think we all have this gut feeling, because there's many a times that I'll listen to our president or conservative media, because it is there, and I feel like the sad liberal is, oh, they make me feel bad for being a liberal. I mean, we all can feel bad, or we can come to the table like he did and thank you, or like we're doing, and have a discussion about it.
That's the least Orwellian part of this, by the way. We're all welcomed, and Paul and everyone, welcome to call. Greg Gerard, what do you think?
My thought is that Paul said he's 50 and went to McQuaid, and I'm 53 and went to McQuaid. So my when I approach a situation like this, I'd say, Paul, let's sit down and have a beer and talk. And we probably would have some agree to disagree points, and we would hopefully find some common ground to at least understand each other better. That's where I always try to go there. And I come, again, from the gay Catholic struggle. So that's where my focus or my mind always goes. But it ties in with the discussion we're having right now.
Okay. Alex?
Well, I think it's a fascinating discussion. I mean, going back to, you know, just language, and if you just look at, you know, Fox News and CNN, it's like they're definitely presenting two different points of view, and sometimes each of them get the facts right, and sometimes each of them get the facts wrong, and I think more than anything, they're presenting two different points of view on reality. And things like, the whole way that, the naming of global warming was changed to climate change. Okay, so we all now talk about it in terms of climate change, but the issue still remains the issue. And even though they've tried to suppress the issue, the issue is still real, or in terms of, you know, talking about undocumented immigrants instead of illegal aliens. Well, regardless of how we name them, you know, there still exists this global refugee crisis. So it's sort of like we can present different points of view, but ultimately it's like, well, we're going to have to deal with the realities of things.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Frank in Greece. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I just, if anyone loves Orwell as much as I do and loves Winston Churchill as much as I do, I suggest you go to your local public library and get a wonderful 250-page book by a author's name is Ricks, R-I-C-K-S. It's called Orwell and Churchill. It's about the formative years from about 1900 to 1950, about these two magnificent men and how they were both far more complex and far more sensitive and far more experienced and far more protean than anyone ever imagined. I love Churchill because he's the least politically correct human being that ever lived. And yet, the more you study about him, you realize that he was big in spirit. And you look at the tremendous amounts of hardship he had to overcome, and both as a young man and then finally as one of the few, very few, pillars of freedom between us and fascism and the Third Reich. As far as Orwell was a young socialist, a true socialist fighting in Spain during the Civil War, was darn near killed and went on to write Homage to Catalonia. And as hard as it is to believe, there's a great deal of socialist feeling both in Europe and the United States. And Orwell became disillusioned with socialism. And what's also scary is how much fascist feeling there was, quiet, firm fascist feeling there was in both England and in the United States. So again, 250 pages, public library, and the author's name is Ricks, R-I-C-K-S, and the book is Churchill and Orwell.
Churchill and Orwell. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate that. And Carol in Rochester wants to jump in with her own recommendation as well. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for getting back to literature and not politics. when Marge Piercy was here in Rochester at Writers and Books, mentored her lecture and asked her later how she felt about the book she wrote in 1991 called He, She, and It, in which she ties together the 1600 pogroms in Prague, and in 2017 when a nuclear conflagration blows Jerusalem off the map, causing nuclear fallout to make us all live under domes, and the haves and the have-nots live in their assigned places. And then it's set in 2059, the younger character, and she is involved with a completely different society, and electrodes are planted in your brain so that there's no such thing as a computer. And guess what? You talk to the house, and the house turns on the lights. Guess what? So it was prescient at the time. I've reread it several times as years have gone on, as I have 1984, because of that same thing. Wow, I have a different viewpoint now. I'm different, so is the world. And it is remarkable how authors, and hats off to you all there, can see these kind of things in the futures. I don't think computers were all that prevalent even when she wrote this book, and yet everything is now done in cyberspace. So it's amazing that she did this. It's a real great read, and I wish it would be reissued so it would get some press now.
And the name of the book again, Carol?
He, She, and It.
Thank you, Carol. He, She, and It, and A House That Talks to You. Hey, Google. Find me a song. We're all talking to the house now. And so, yeah, a lot of prescience there. Well, let's close the hour with some prescience, and let's ask our panelists. Alex, if you were writing a book called 2054, 35 years in the future, just as Orwell was doing in 1949 when he wrote 1984, what are the issues, what concerns you the most that would be sort of thematic in a book about 2054, Alex?
Well, you know, sometimes when I read the dystopian works, it's sort of like they've taken current individuals and current social structures and societies and sort of implanted them in a future world. And what's exciting for me, you know, as I write about, you know, changes in identity and gender and sexuality and attitudes around those issues and others in culture, what would be exciting for me is in a dystopian work to look at how we as individuals and societies and cultures and how we relate to each other, how that will have changed in 30 years or 50 years, because it's sort of like what's exciting for me today is seeing how rapidly, you know, young people, how they interact and relate, you know, in many ways differently from when I was growing up, and how as adults, how we're changing, how we interact with each other is in part because of technology. And so to see, you know, how our institutions are changing, how that's changing us as cultures and societies. So really focus on how we as individuals and cultures will have changed in the future.
Okay. Greg Girard.
So 2054, to me, my husband and I was helping me brainstorm before we came on today, and he brought up the point, you know, with robotics and with AI, what is the job of the future? What are people going to do in 35 years? And if there are more robots and more automation, there's going to be less and less things for us to do as humans. So I'm a Star Trek fan, so I envision not so dystopian, but I like the Gene Roddenberry thought that in the future we will, because there is so much automation, we will expand ourselves and explore, and better the betterment of humanity will be the goal of the day, not to earn a living or to fight each other.
Well, I would say, Christine Green, at least from my perspective, the book that is the most like 1984, warning of a true possible collapse of order based on possible future problems, is set a little bit later than 35 years in the future. Writers and Books brought in Omar El-Akkad, who wrote American War, which I thought was extraordinary. In a sense, it's about climate change, but it's also about a society. It's about terrorism. So put that on your list, American War. What about you?
So as I was thinking right here, someone said talk to your house all the time, right? Turn your lights on.
Yeah.
I have a friend, she's probably listening out. Her husband, he will absolutely not do a genetic test, right? Because he doesn't want Big Brother to have it, but he'll talk to his Alexa all the time. So I want to write a crime mystery set where the government actually does get a hold of your DNA results, and how do they solve crimes with them, but how does it go terribly awry, too?
Wow. Well, people would never just give the government, just give up their privacy and stuff like that. Meanwhile, here's a 10,000 words on Facebook's privacy agreement. Just click the box at the bottom without reading it.
Yeah.
Christine, thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
Greg Girard, thank you very much. Greg, author of Jupiter's Shadow, among other works. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan, for having me back.
And Alex Sanchez, who is the author of Rainbow Boys and working on a graphic novel for DC Comics. Alex, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. It was great.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.